Good evening. Hi, I'm Trish England, and welcome to Race Talk with Trish, produced by Dave Wallen and the Racing History Project. Did you know all our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them on the Racing History Project website, www.racinghistoryproject.com, and also catch our recordings on iHeartRadio, and coming soon, you can get it on Amazon. Tonight's show should be very revealing about the lives of racing drivers and team owners in the years spanning IMSA, Camel GT, WEC, WSC, Grand Am, and back to IMSA. We're talking with fathers and sons, the dads who blazed the trails, won the trophies, and inspired their sons through example and inspiration, and the sons who watched and listened as early as grade school, soaking up their father's experiences and instruction, acclimating themselves to the tracks of their second homes. Our guests tonight are Bob and Rich Leitzinger, Wayne and Jordan Taylor, and Rob and Chris Dyson. Bob Leitzinger is still at it. He's been racing for over 50 years, starting out in sports cars, and SCCA, Trans Am, and later in IMSA, driving Lotuses and Datsuns. He knew the future was about to change when Butch hit the track and beat him at Mid-Ohio. Together, they built a NASCAR team and campaigned that for about 7 years or so before returning to IMSA. Butch's career exploded, and he raced with the best drivers of Dyson and Alex Jones teams and others, winning championships and scoring great finishes at Le Mans along the way. Now Butch is retired from driving, and Daddy Bob is still running the Lotus Elan in vintage racing. Some guys never quit. Wayne Taylor came to the States from South Africa to compete in IMSA, and he never left. He raced with his own team successfully in 2014 or so as his sons were taken to the track in their late teens. They've been at the top of their game in every car and every class they've ever started. Their seasons often overlapped. Sometimes they raced together. Sometimes they competed against each other, but they never strayed far from WTR. Jordan has won 5 championships in 9 years in IMSA, along with 2 24 hours of Daytona wins. This weekend, Ricky is testing at Le Mans, and we're sorry to miss him. But the guy has his priorities straight. Wayne and Jordan will have plenty of Ricky stories in his absence. I remember Rob Dyson in a Firebird in the GTO class in the early to mid-80s, and in 962s in GTP, and Riley and Scott in WSC. He seemed to enjoy running his team and driving his car more than anybody, as if serious business can be fun. Chris was 23 when he dived headfirst into IMSA, mostly competing with Rob on the Dyson team, but he hopped around with other teams, cars, and series, racing overseas whenever he could and seeing the world through racetracks. In 2017, he was welcomed into Trans Am and expanded upon his early successes. He won the championship last year and has a huge lead in points so far in 22. I saw him race at Road Atlanta a month ago, and he is the real deal. So, audience, please mute your phones. If you have a question, just send it via chat, and our producer will pass it along. Would you like, any of the guys like to introduce themselves?
Okay, yeah, Bob Leitzinger here.
Hi, this is Wayne Taylor here.
Butch Leitzinger.
Jordan Taylor.
Chris Dyson.
Rob Dyson.
Yay. I got a question for the dads. Is driving talent hereditary, or does your boys learn it from you? Did you ever send them to driving schools or use coaches?
Go ahead, Wayne. Give it a try.
Well, firstly, I don't think you can teach a kid to drive a racing car fast. You've either got a certain amount of talent or you don't have. And it's like Roger Penske would say, it's easier to slow a fast guy down than it is to speed a slow guy up. So I think that natural talent is probably the most important ingredient, and that certainly happened with me, with both Jordan, who's on the phone, and with Ricky. And sometimes that's not a good idea. So sometimes it's not so good because then they end up having to live in this world that we do, which is not as easy as everybody thinks.
Yeah, I can well imagine. Any of the dads concur with that, or they have a different viewpoint?
Well, Bob here, and I would concur with Wayne, but with both my boys, Chuck, Kurtz, and Butch, they were really fast learners, and I would get out of a car when Butch was, maybe, 5 years old, 6 years old, and he would start asking me questions about why this, why that, and he was just a very fast learner.
A little sponge, huh?
Yeah, I agree with both these guys. I think that when Chris first started racing, he was fairly talented, but frankly, I didn't think he was going to get into racing because he was a highly accomplished stick and ball guy, all county basketball, baseball, hits a golf ball 5 miles, 300 miles, but he took to it pretty quickly. And I think what it is the fathers created the atmosphere where they kind of got the sense of what it's about by osmosis, but the basic talent has to be there. I absolutely agree with Wayne. They have to have the desire and the talent to make it work.
Well, that answers the question that I've had for a long time, because I've seen a number of fathers and sons, and it's fascinating to watch. But you answered my question about if your kids wanted to do anything other than racing. And Chris, I could see he could do just about anything.
My mother wishes I would have done anything else, I think.
I've seen that be a problem in families before, too, where the sons kind of had to sneak off and race.
Well, I think this is Butch. I think one of the real benefits of growing up in a racing family is that we didn't have to sneak off. I think this is true for Rob. I know it's true for my dad, and I don't know about Wayne, but I think they didn't come from racing families. Their parents didn't really understand it or necessarily approve of it. So they were having to do it all on their own and learn everything on their own and sometimes on the sly. Whereas for me anyway, growing up immersed in it, my dad just said that I was a quick learner, but actually it wasn't really very quick. It was over 18 years of being around it, as Rob said, of the osmosis of just eventually everything getting in my brain, so that when it finally came time to drive, I'd already learned a lot that a person just coming into it on their own gets thrown at them all at once. Whereas, at least I was able to, and like maybe for the other sons, similar, where you're able to kind of have this very slow immersion into it. And so when you actually get in the car, you don't have quite as many things to be assaulting your senses.
Well, I can see that from your family, because your whole family came to all the races. I remember your mom, and you just didn't, it was just all y'all together doing what you did.
Yes, and you're right.
I have some of her artwork.
The entire family was. Yeah, this is Butch again, and the entire family was involved with him. My older brother raced also, so you know, the
and I don't remember him. I remember you as a kid, but I do not remember your older brother. I'm sorry.
Oh yeah, Chuck Kurtz is my older brother, and you know, we drove together in Firehawk series and also with the GTU, and but you know, so just being at the dinner table, you know, and hearing, you know, the conversation, you know, as the youngest of the family, I got the benefit of all of their experience.
Yeah, this is Wayne again. I would say this, that both Jordan and Ricky, when they were young, obviously I and Shelley had moved, yeah, Ricky from South Africa in 1990 and started in the IMSA Camel series. And then Jordan was born in 91. Neither Ricky nor Jordan had any interest in racing at all. And as I continued to try and build a life in America, it was really just Shelley and I that were together, and we were raising these two kids. And when we got here, we thought nothing further than me making it as a racing driver. And so the kids, we'd start taking them to the racetrack, but they were more interested in kicking a soccer ball around than doing anything in racing. And then when they were sort of 8 and 9, I think, or 8 and 10, I decided that I wanted to take them to a go-kart race just simply because they were sitting in front of TVs all the time and all these games that they play, and I felt that they needed to be outdoors. So we took them to a go-kart track race, and it wasn't long before I could see that the two of them had talent in two different ways, but they still weren't really interested, because as soon as we'd go to the go-kart track, I mean, I used to drive down to Homestead, 4 hours down there on a Sunday morning and 4 hours back on Sunday evening for months. But it was only in 2005 when I had got into Grand Am, and that was with Bill Riley and SunTrust and everything. And for some reason, it was like a light switch, because suddenly both of them just wanted to be involved in racing in every aspect. Jordan was very methodical about the way he went about it. He could not only drive the race car, but I think he has further skills than just to drive the car. I think he understands the management of the programs and this kind of stuff, which is pretty unique. And, you know, when you move countries and you don't have any family other than your wife and your two kids, and you're trying to make it as a racing driver, it's not that easy. And so I had always felt as a kid that everything would end when I stopped driving. And I never thought that I'd ever want to stop. But what happened was the kids became successful only because we were lucky in that we chose a certain route to go for both of them, and it all worked out. And then I realized that, you know, I was starting to get to the place where I'd had enough of the driving, and I had enough of dealing with team owners and team managers and sponsors and stuff as a driver, and felt, you know, this was the time to put my effort into them. And from that point on, they have created themselves what they have today. They live and eat the sport. They are fully programmed to the health and fitness and stuff. I'm sure you guys have seen that. But it would be interesting for Jordan to, if Jordan could say a little bit, Jordan, tell us about what your view was, if it was as close as my view that I've just said. Is that how it all happened? That's the way I remember it. I remember sitting in the kitchen every Christmas time thinking, how much money do we have? Can we afford to go take them karting? And then I realized karting became ridiculously expensive, and I thought karting could only teach you a certain amount. Then you have to jump into a car, and we chose Skip Barber, which I thought was a good thing to put a driver in a car that's not very easy to deal with, and that's when it all started. So, Jordan, I think you can give your input here.
Yeah, I mean, we obviously grew up going to the racetrack, you know, through the 90s. And Ricky and I, like my dad was saying, was we weren't super interested in the driving side. It was just, you know, like any family that goes to a baseball field on the weekend or a football field, for us it was going to the racetrack. So it was, for us it was just like a normal weekend. So I think once our dad retired from the driving full time, and he could kind of put some focus into teaching us a little bit more of the driving side and what went into it, was what really got us interested. And I think once we did make the switch from go-karts to cars into the Skip Barber Racing School to kind of understand more of the dynamics of a race car, of what makes it go fast and why it understeers or why it oversteers, brought a whole new interest for us, for the sport and the business side. So I think it just intrigued us, and it was a life that we wanted to pursue, and we're very fortunate, you know, to be born into a family with parents that were in the sport and that loved the sport and would support us in the sport as well, and opened a lot of doors for us. So it definitely made things easier for us that we're very thankful for. But I think everyone on here can admit that you need a lot of things to go your way, a lot of breaks and a lot of doors to open at the right time to put yourself in good positions. So yeah, both Ricky and I are always thankful of where we've gotten to, and definitely, you know, thank our parents for pretty much all the support and putting us in the right place at the right times.
Well, this is to the other youngins. Did any of the of you other sons do a Skip Barber or something like that to get your feet wet at the beginning?
Well, this is Bob here. Both Chuck and Butch had the desire to do racing just because we were so involved in everything. But I had always had the feeling that if you wanted to be a race driver, you had to be wanting to be a race driver bad enough to do just about anything. And so Sandra and I talked to the kids about it, and when Butch and Chuck both told me they wanted to get into racing, I was pleased, but it was not us pushing them at all. We don't feel that's the right way to do things, but they both wanted to, so we said, okay, you got to have a backup plan, and that is, you get a good education, you keep your nose clean, and we will help you as much as we can, but you guys got to work on the cars. You got to help on them and get to know them. And they both did, and they both showed, I would call it natural talent, when they first started going, and we were just thrilled to help them, and they went on from there.
They certainly did.
Yeah, I think the approach that I took on it was that that I seriously didn't think that Chris was going to be all that interested, but I think that my dad and Chris would come to all of the races or a lot of races, and I think that by the acceptance of my dad was no race car driver and didn't aspire ever to it. But I don't know, Chris, when you started getting the bug, how did you get into it?
I don't think you were paying attention, Dad, because I was really interested in the whole time I was going to all those races with you guys as a kid. And, you know, the good thing was you were never pushing it, so I had to actually come to it myself, which I'm thankful for, and that's the approach I'm taking with my own kids. It was intoxicating to be around IMSA GTP and, all that amazing stuff that was going on in the 80s and 90s, you know, seeing my dad and everybody, all the heroes, and Wayne got to race. I got to see Wayne run when I was a kid out at Lime Rock when he was running that Intrepid. And, you know, the crowds, the excitement, the cars, and obviously the vibe of the team. You get around that environment of the guys, as a kid especially, it's so supportive. And it really lifts your spirits. You want to be part of that. You want to be part of that game. And, you know, from that point on, it was just a matter of how do you get into it. But I think when you're a kid that grows up in racing, it's just second nature. You kind of get it through osmosis.
Well, by then, you already know how teams work, and that's a major step. And you're friends with the team members by that time. They've seen you growing up and watching you, and they've been watching out for you. So it was just a natural step, and it seemed to me. So that brings me a question. Is driving for your dad more or less stressful than driving for a friend's team?
I would say it's
good question. Good question.
I'm interested in that answer, too.
I can start.
Who's that?
It's got pros and cons. This is Jordan. It's got pros and cons. Obviously, you know, you always want an honest answer from your team owner and an honest perspective. And I think with family, you'll always get that. You'll always get good feedback, whether it's, you know, something you want to hear, something you're not, something more constructive criticism. And that was always going to be there. The good things are, you know, when you win as a family, there's nothing better than that. You know, winning big races together and beating everyone else as a family is something you can take a lot of pride in. And then you can still go home and fly home together, have family dinner together, and talk about all the stories. The tough times are obviously when the races go badly. You know, it's sometimes a tough situation when it is family. But I wouldn't have changed anything that we did in the past. I think we made some of our best memories of all of our lives, you know, kind of competing together at some of the biggest races. You know, something I always loved. So, yeah, I'll always cherish those memories.
Yeah, this
Anybody
is
else?
Butch, and,
all over.
Yeah, and I'd have to say, you know, in my instance anyway, it was a lot less stress driving for the family team, just because, you know, growing up with it, you know, you know with racing, it's not like other sports where, you know, like a good season is when you win, you know, half of your games. You know, in racing, if you win once or twice a year, it's good, and you know, quite often the results are you know, pretty poor at the end of the weekend, you know, especially at for a privateer team. So you know, so with the family team, you know, if it was a bad weekend, you know, you definitely felt bad about it, but it wasn't something that was completely unknown. You know, it was just something that you got through and went on to the next weekend. You know, as you get up into the more higher professional teams, you know, the expectations become much much higher, and the stress levels get higher also. So, yeah, it was a lovely way to enter into racing with the family. Not having to perform like the kids that you see now, the ones that are kind of going through all these programs, where at 16 they've already got 10 years of karting, and you know, they're expected to produce, you know, at 16 with huge levels of pressure on them. I can't even imagine what they're going through, because
I know,
you know, back in my day, you know, at 20 years old you're considered a youngster, you know, and everyone kind of gave you a benefit of doubt if you did something silly. You know, threw the car off the road, they'd say, well, you know, he's learning. And now, my gosh, if a kid has two bad races in a row at 17 or 18, you know, people start to write them off already. So it's, I think I kind of had a very kind of gentle upbringing of coming into racing.
One of the joys, there's Bob here, that we experience, and me in particular, was enjoying their success. I can remember when Butch really showed his true colors, was at Mid-Ohio in an IMSA race driving the GTU cars. And we were first and second, or first and third, something like that. And we talked about the start, and everything went very well for us. We went about five laps, and we were leading first and second and moving away from the field. So that was just great until I was going into turn five, and holy, Butch was right beside me, and he had the turn and went on to win the race. And I never out-qualified him or beat him after that. And the pleasure and joy that I had in that, I think Wayne and Rob will agree, joy that you have at that time, you can't trade it for anything. It's everything.
And as is Wayne here, things now in racing are so different to when Chris and Butch grew up, and Rob and I, and you guys, that we were able to convince either team owners or managers or sponsors or manufacturers that we were really fast. And in those days, there was no telemetry. They would ask you, for example, at Monza, when you go through the Lesmo, the two Lesmo curves, the first thing they would ask you is, are you flat in fourth gear? And of course, you as a driver would say, yes, we're flat in fourth gear. Nowadays, there's so much telemetry, they know every single thing that you do. And if you go and go to Le Mans, as many times as I've been there, in the last 10 years, all that everybody does is stand and look at the TV screens and watch every driver in every section, and they know exactly. And so I think today, talent has become much harder to find than when we were competing. And I think, you know, in my case, racing was going to be my life, and I was not going to fail, no matter what. And it was always, as a driver, never had any thoughts of being a team owner. And I was never, you know, I was never going to fail as a driver, was in my mind. And today, as now, you know, running this racing team and stuff, and I used to always think to myself that the racing driver that I was the most important person on the team. And now, being an owner, I've realized that the racing driver is probably the least important, because it costs $1 million to find a tenth of a second, so it's pretty easy just to change the driver. And you have enough knowledge now and telemetry and real-time information that you know whether this driver actually knows what they're doing or doesn't know. So I think, you know, in sports car racing in our days, in the 80s and 90s, you could drive until you were, I don't know, 55, almost 60 years old, you had a life. But right now, you know, when you get to 35 in a sports car, you're already looked at as, you know, you're part of the old program. That you look now for 25-year-olds to 35-year-olds, because the technology and the speed and the commitment is so much greater. And so many eyes are on you, and so many, and the manufacturers know exactly what you're doing. And so it's done a 360 degrees, because now with the new LMDH program, all you have to do is call around and see what drivers are available. And I can tell you that I spend most of my life looking at drivers, and I never thought I'd ever be looking at drivers at 22 years old. Because, you know, my kids now, Ricky and Jordan, are 31 and 32, which is the prime of their careers, but they're not at the very beginning anymore. And so it has changed dramatically. And So your life expectancy as a driver can only keep you going for so many years. It's like watching this weekend with Scott Dixon getting the pole at Indy, where you would say, you know, he'd be a difficult guy to hire right now when he's at the point that he's won six championships and in his early 40s. And, you know, he doesn't have any teammates, so revert back to sports cars again. You just have to have the drivers that know the job and can get on with their teammates and not try and out-qualify or outdo each other, which is a key ingredient today on how you win these big races. Whereas in the past, we would have to worry about, would the car last? And, you know, would we have enough fuel? And, you know, just easy things. Today, every single lap is like a qualifying lap for these guys. And you can't do that in your 40s anymore. It's just impossible.
Yeah, hi, this is Rob. I think that Wayne has hit a nail right on the head. I think that what's happening is racing has changed. When Scott Dixon did what he did, you could get the sense that people were saying, well, that's kind of a fluke because he's so old. And I agree that what's happening is with telemetry and all the other things, a driver can't lie to the crew at all. You know, you're touching the brake, when are you doing the braking and all that, because the amount of data that they can bring to bear on not just the car's performance, but on the driver's, is really staggering. But I will tell you, the one thing that is interesting is when you see the one thing is that none of the fathers on this call forced their kids to get into racing. They just got into racing because of, I think all three of us, the older guys, were successful and had good reputations, and the kids benefited from the experience that we all had, which we had no problem sharing. I think that's the key component. Nowadays, I think that I'm not sure that you can have that kind of component anymore, because the churn of drivers is getting so intense that it, you know, you don't see a family kind of a environment.
Not at all.
You know, no. You don't see it. I don't think.
This is Wayne. Rob, I think you are completely right in that you don't see the family situation anymore. I think I'm extremely lucky that I still have that, because I have the team, and I have Ricky driving for me, and Jordan can always come back to me or whatever. But clearly now with the LMDH and Hypercar, the team owners or manufacturers are very, very aggressive when they go out and look for drivers and stuff. And the amount that's going on by these manufacturers, you know, you've got to have a driver that you can just put in and do the job. It's a plug-and-play situation. And I want to just clarify the Scott Dixon thing, is that as much as he's at the age he is, for what he did at Indy was pretty incredible. And he drove for me, Jordan, you've been checking with me. I know he drove for me at Daytona. We won one 24-hour together. I'm not sure if we did one or two together. And
I remember that.
He is the most laid-back, quiet guys that I've ever met in racing. He is super fit and strong, and he still can pull out what he did this weekend, which is what I think is pretty incredible.
I'm not taking it away from him, believe me.
No, but, you know, the big thing is, really, as a racing driver, you've always got to think ahead. I certainly didn't. All the drivers I ever drove with, they always talked about how much money do you have to retire, because once you stop driving, you know, what's left in your life? That's what you think. and I had absolutely no intentions of ever being a team owner. I just thought I'd race the rest of my life. And somehow I fell into this, and it's just as exciting as it was driving, to be honest. And then to have both my kids in it just makes it just really fantastic. So I feel very humbled and lucky that I've been able to do this.
Well, speaking of younger upcoming drivers, how many of them, they really didn't need to be trained by someone, they had simulators?
Yeah. Well, I think Butch and Jordan and can talk about simulators. I mean, we didn't have simulators. If I had to sit in the simulator, I would probably get seasick.
I would. I've tried it. It doesn't work for me.
This is Rob. I found a simulator be nauseating. I sat in the simulator at the Dallara here in Indianapolis, and it's. I guess if you grow up in it, then I don't know. Maybe Ricky and Jordan, they're younger guys. Chris, I don't know. Did you do anything in the simulators?
Yeah, I love the simulators. I mean, I've only been on them a couple of times, but you know, I grew up playing way too many video games, and I loved them. If I had them when I was younger, I don't think I would have ever left the house.
There is one sitting outside my office at Jim Downing's shop, and he won't play with it because he says he gives him headaches, he makes him nauseated. He won't use it.
This is Butch, and my experience in simulators was limited to, actually, Chris, you might remember this, when we were doing the Mazda program, they brought a simulator around a couple times, and I would try to get on it, and they had Lime Rock loaded into it, and I tried for probably about half an hour to do it, and I could never actually make one complete lap without completely destroying the simulated car in it. So
that's a difficult track to do anyway.
But it was really embarrassing because that's like where I grew up pretty much, and I realized through that I must drive like through fear, you know, where I eventually put my foot on the brake pedal whenever I just can't stand it anymore. And the video game, I don't quite have that impending doom coming up.
Oh, neat. Chris, I've got a burning question for you. Sprint cars in the Chili Bowl. What was that like?
Great. The Chili Bowl.
Apparently.
Well, the Chili Bowl is an event unlike anything else you'll ever see anywhere. It's, you know, you got 375 cars in the same building. People are there for 6 days.
And it's in a building, for God's sake.
Yes, it's totally wild. It's in January.
I went to one. It's been a long time, but I went to one.
Yeah, no, it's an amazing event, and the excitement level is just, it's not, first of all, it's nonstop action. And, you know, when you first get there, you see the amount of crashes and you see the flipping. It's a little bit shocking. And then, you know, a couple of days later, it's just a yawn. I mean, it's one of the few races where they have a flip count. You know, that gets up in the upper 70s by the end of the week. That just kind of tells you kind of what you're dealing with. It's one of the few places where I've actually passed someone. Yeah, no, it's one of the few races, Trish, where I've actually passed someone who's above me in the air. But it's so much fun and great driving. The talent there is incredible. And that's the case, I think, for all dirt racing in this country. I think, you know, there's so much grassroots talent in the country. And you know, in road racing, we don't, you know, I think sometimes the worlds tend to get a little bit siloed. I was really fortunate to get to do some sprint cars and Silver Crown racing. I encourage anybody to do it. You know, I don't think Jordan would probably be allowed to do it, but if you get the chance, buddy, give it a shot.
Yeah.
Well, tell us why Jordan wouldn't be allowed.
Well, Jordan's driving for factories, and they probably wouldn't take a kind view towards going out on wheels,
okay.
Sprint cars, but maybe he's got some cool owners.
Yeah.
if you can, bud.
Contract
if you ever get the
details,
chance, do
right.
it as soon as you can.
Yeah, it's always worth asking.
How about Pike's Peak?
No, I'm not going to Pike's Peak. I don't like the idea of going off the road and plunging like 2,000 feet into an abyss. I've had enough nightmares in my life. I don't need to live that one.
I've seen more videos of that sort of thing than I'd like to remember.
Yeah. You know, one thing we haven't talked about and is the wanting to keep on racing just your entire time. With me, I kept on doing vintage car racing, and for the record, I haven't run a race since 2017, so I'm not, all my cars are parked, but
Jim's still racing.
Now, the pleasure that is still out there for what we knew is vintage car racing, and that has just been an awful lot of fun. I uh-huh. would like to have just kept on going, but you know, when you get a little too old for the pro ranks, and I could see that coming, that vintage car racing is still a lot of fun, and it gets back to the families also.
Right. Yeah, I went to the MIDI. Jim brought a new car. Well, not new, but it didn't do real well for him. But he's still out there doing it. He's 80, but he's not going to quit. And he said he didn't do it. HSR. That's it.
Hey, we got a question from the audience here. If you got a minute.
Sure.
Sure.
Yeah, the from our chat room. For each of you old guys, what did you start racing in and when?
I couldn't quite understand that.
I didn't hear the question.
For the old guys, and you can identify whoever that is, but when did you start racing in and what?
Well, I started racing when I was about 23, I guess. But continued up, and we had the IMSA GTU team, and I was in my 50s and still competitive. In vintage racing, there is, it's not just out doing parade laps. People are taking it very seriously, and I think a lot of people are there because they weren't getting what they wanted in club racing, and they have found great pleasure in it.
Yeah, this is Wayne. I started when I was 15 years ago. I mean, sorry, when I was 15 years old. So that was 1966. Yeah, 1971.
Yeah, this is Rob. I was 28 when I started in 1974. And I will. I think it is interesting. I think that the interesting aspect of the cars that have changed. Like Wayne just kind of touched on it. The cars nowadays, the thing that's so impressive, you take the 24 hours of Daytona, the thing that's so impressive about it, with the vast number of cars that they had, very few of them break. A couple of them crash out, and there's some screw-ups maybe in the pits where they lose a wheel or they come together with somebody else, an accident of some sort. But if you're running the cars, nowadays they rarely break. And Wayne is absolutely right. You wanted a veteran driver in a car because they knew how to nurse a car, how to preserve it. And that kind of art, the art of the mechanical sympathy in the with the automobile has kind of been obviated by the fact that the cars are so well built and they're so bulletproof.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
As a result, you can put somebody in that's fast and they don't necessarily really have to care about those aspects of the car, or at least not as much as we used to have to.
Well, when you think back when we started, Rob, what was the death count in racing back then? I started, they were killing a driver a week, and my parents were just terrified whenever I would just talk nothing but racing. And one time my dad said at Thanksgiving dinner, Bob, if all you're going to do is talk about racing, don't bother coming home for Christmas. And boy, did that hit. So I never mentioned another thing at home about racing. And then when he read in the paper that I won a race at Nelson Ledges, he called and said, what the heck's going on? I said, well, Dad, remember last Thanksgiving? He said, yeah, but damn it, I want to be there now. So he came to many, many races after that and really enjoyed it and were great supporters. But the danger element, you wonder how many people would be doing this today if we were at those kind of numbers.
Well, I will tell you when I got into a pretty spectacular wreck with Paul Newman at a club race out at Nelson Ledges, and it made the front page of my local newspaper. And the first person that called me, because I'm a businessman, the first person that called me was my banker. The second person was the insurance man. And you're right. The thing that I had to fight a well-known, the head of our local utility, when he saw me once in some social environment, he came up to me and said, do you have a death wish? Because in those days, that was really the prevailing wisdom. And when Wayne started, it was the same thing. I mean, in that era, the late 60s, early 70s, when the speeds of cars were really increasing, and the tracks weren't any better, and in point of fact, the cars weren't any safer.
Yep.
You know, we were all really kind of ignoring a partial reality of racing.
Yeah.
Which fortunately has lessened significantly since.
Yeah, which is a great thing about the quote.
I'm going to have to take a station identification break. Is that okay? This won't take
sure.
me a minute. We'll go back to it. Guess what? All our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them on the Racing History Project website, www.racinghistoryproject.com, and on the Internet Archive, archive.org. And now you can catch our recordings on iHeartRadio and Amazon. Thank you. To the boys. Some of you have spread out to other teams from time to time. Who are your favorite co-drivers?
Boy, this is Butch. That's a really tough one. I've had some great ones, yeah. You know, actually, a lot of them on this call, actually. You know, my father, my brother, my first co-drivers, and they were fantastic just in that they're both really good and completely open and trying to help me get better. You know, and then Rob and Chris, when I went to the Dyson team, they were, you know, very much kind of like the family atmosphere that I had left with my own family team. You know, both always very straightforward and just trying to do everything to get the whole team forward and no politics involved. And Wayne, I was never actually teammates in the same car, but we were teammates in the Cadillac team was it 2000. So I had some, you know, just great associations just on this call, but you know, I mean, the roster of the everyone that came through the Dyson program. I mean James Weaver, Andy Wallace, EFR, John Paul Jr. You know, that we just lost last year, I guess it was now. Dorsey, Trader. It honestly just goes on and on. So. This is one of the things I could never actually pick a best co-driver because there was just too much.
Well, they were friends.
Yeah, that's the other part of it. That, you know, they were great relationships too. It wasn't just, you know, this is the driver that I scored the best results with. You know, there were people that I really got an emotional, friendship with, and. So I wouldn't want to pick any.
Yeah, this is Jordan. I mean, I think the cool thing about, you know, sports car racing is that you do get lots of different teammates mixed in, especially for endurance races, and especially these days with Daytona, you get a lot of the superstars that come from around the world, from NASCAR and Formula One and IndyCar, so I've definitely been fortunate to drive with some cool guys, and you know, everyone you drive with, you can learn something different from you know, their history and their certain racing disciplines, whether it's a Jeff Gordon from NASCAR or Alonso from Formula One or a Hunter Ray from IndyCar. It's always interesting to hear, you know, their perspectives, you know, compare yourself with them, see what their strengths and weaknesses are and where you can kind of learn and improve on. And I think that's a unique thing that we have in sports car racing as opposed to, you know, a single driver formula where, you know, your teammate's your biggest rival. For us, we get to work with our teammates and kind of work with each other to push each other. So, yeah, I've definitely been lucky to drive with a lot of great guys. I'd say some of my favorites would be obviously my brother. Ryan Hunter-Reay was probably one of the nicest guys I've ever driven with. And then my current co-driver, Antonio Garcia, is probably one of the smartest and most switched on guys I've been with.
So this is Chris. Trish, I think you asked the question about us moving around and driving with other people. I mean, Butch listed all the great guys we've had on our team, and I would not pick any of them as, you know, one above the other. They're all family. But venturing outside of the team and getting over to Le Mans for the first time with Jan Lammers has to be up there with my all-time great racing memories. I mean, just seeing Jan in his element over there, you know, race winner, kind of an icon, a Dutch icon, racing for Holland, just seeing him just kind of getting all of his inside knowledge about Le Mans, you know, all the little idiosyncrasies of the track and just soaking it in, and just the charisma and the fun of being with him for that week. You know, I'll never forget that. And a lot of the stuff he told me my first time there, I've never forgotten ever since I've driven there.
Think you'll ever make it back?
Yeah, I'd love to go back.
There's somebody out there wanting you. Okay. Give me some funny stuff. Tell me a funny story.
Jordan's got all the funny stories.
Yeah, I can share one. I'd say it's a kind of a generational story where, kind of as we were talking about before, as the cars have developed and the technology has kind of come a long way, where, you know, back in the 80s or 90s, you only have a couple switches in the car to worry about. And, you know, these days we've got, you know, 20 buttons on the steering wheel to activate different things. And my dad had retired from driving and came back in 2014 to do Daytona with us. And obviously the car was much different from kind of the last thing he raced kind of in his career. So there was a lot to learn, a lot of new buttons. and things, and he didn't do much practice, and, you know, we were in the middle of the Rolex 24. I think it was, you know, close to midnight, middle of the race, and we were going to restart, and he pushed the wrong button and actually turned the whole car off when we were supposed to be going green. So the team definitely got a good laugh at that one, but I think that's a good, you know, generational example of how much the, you know, times have changed in race cars, but, you know,
it was still, the field is not over.
Jordan, sorry? That might have been funny for you, but it was pretty scary for me.
Oh, I'll bet. I would have done the same thing, I know it. Oh, that's wild.
I could tell you one funny story just about, Dad and I got to do a few races together, the top memories actually for me. And I'll never forget the time that we were down driving at Daytona together, and we were racing with Max Crawford. And I think it was one of Dad's last years, maybe like his second to last one that he did. And we're sitting there in the driver's lounge with Ollie Gavin and Guy Smith and I. And we're having a conversation. We're talking about driving the infield. And we start talking about the Riley and the Crawford. My dad sort of comes in, and he hears like part of what we're saying. And what he heard was the dog leg was definitely flat. But he leaves the driver's lounge, and what he didn't realize was we were talking about the difference between the Riley and the Crawford. So he goes out in the next session and proceeds to try
to take
the dog leg, absolutely ripping flat in the Crawford. Does, I don't know if he did like a 540 or like a 720, but he comes in and he's like, I just had the craziest spin. And I go, what did you try to do? He says, well, I was trying to take the corner flat. And I said, well, how did you get that idea? And he says, well, I heard you guys talking about it in the driver's lounge, and I just figured it was now or never.
I will give you the same reply that Wayne had. It may be funny to you, but it wasn't funny for me. I took it flat out, and the next thing I knew, I did a complete 360, and I was facing into the kink. As I went through the kink, I was facing right down to the hairpin, and I said, see, I've never really ever done that before, and I'm never going to do it again.
Time to come in and change the Nomad. Oh, no.
Butch, I don't think you can tell many of our stories on Trish's podcast, can you?
Oh, yeah, we've had the BTU boys. We can hear anything you can come up with.
I think on the Leisinger family side, I think, you know, actually most of the humor, you know, is, again, it's like one of the things that's funny now, was in the actually getting to the races, because back then we were normally, we'd have an RV, towing a very, very overloaded trailer full of cars.
I remember that.
Yeah, and you know, this poor RV would be way overstressed, and usually, you know, there was many, many times of being broken down alongside the road. Actually, I remember one time we were going out to Portland, and for some reason we decided that Mount Vernon wasn't very far away, so we went to look at Mount Vernon with this, you know, monster of a motorhome towing a trailer, and then trying to come down the mountain from it. For some reason, it kicked out of gear, and so it was like relying solely on the brakes, which very quickly overheated, and we were just careening down the road with a very full trailer. And I think for some reason we had like four barrels of racing fuel in the trailer as well. But when we got to the bottom of the hill, the brakes were actually on fire. I had to jump out and extinguish the trailer brakes, because actually it was the trailer brakes that were slowing us down at the bottom. And unfortunately, the light at the bottom of the hill was green. Most of our stories are these kind of things that we've, you know, somehow got through on the way to the racetrack, not so much at the racetrack.
Well, as I recall that, we got back out on 80 and went about 40 miles without touching the brakes. And I said, okay, time to test them. And we hit the brakes and everything worked fine. Okay, we're good to go. And went on to Portland.
Glad to be able to get down the ramp. Oh, goodness. That's scary. Everybody pretty much run what they run back then.
Exactly.
No more funny stories? And y'all been so serious all these years.
I mean, Jordan, I have to say, this guy is a multimedia wizard. He puts out some of the most creative, hilarious stuff.
I've seen some of it.
Possibly on the internet. And I have to say, I commend him for doing it, because as the whole of racing culture has become more buttoned up, boring, you know, corporate and restrained, there's this little pocket of creativity that he puts out, these little kind of skits and alter egos. I got to say, man, it just makes us all laugh. We all appreciate it. I know I've sent you some encouraging notes from time to time. It's off the wall. It's kind of what the sport needs, and I think it's great that you do it. Especially to meet you, buddy. You're, like, so laid back, but I just love that when the camera rolls, you've got this little mind that's just going crazy to come up with these great little expressions that are kind of like a whole send-up of all of it. We appreciate the wit.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I think if social media was around in the 80s or 70s, I'm sure there would be some good characters from back then that would have shown themselves as well.
The funniest thing I ever saw, a photograph of Lewis Hamilton wearing a lace kimono, and you had to do one too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he wears some funny outfits, I tried.
Was that paper? Did you make that out of paper?
I think it was a table.
It looked like toilet paper.
It might have been a tablecloth that I cut up from Walmart.
It worked. It worked beautifully.
Just painstaking filmmaking and craftsmanship there. I have to say, you're a real auteur, bud.
Thank you. I think I've got a little bit too much time on my hands.
You just use your time better than most. You're quite creative.
Thank you.
I always look forward to those.
He definitely could have worked at MTV in the early 90s with his sensibilities.
Oh, I think, yeah. Okay, you've been interviewed by the best, huh?
Got one more question. From a fan.
Okay, we got another question.
There could be a fan of mine who says, you have Rover T70 chassis number one, and Bob Leitzinger also owned that car at one time. Is that true? Is that right, Bob?
Well, you have to repeat that. I didn't hear it.
Yeah, we got some static on that one.
So the fan out here says that you at one time owned Lola T70 chassis number one, about 1968 or so.
Did you say a Lola?
Yeah.
I was asking about a Lola T70.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember that.
I remember that car.
I had decided that I needed that of racing the Lotus and doing very well with it, and decided I needed to get into something like the Can-Am. And a Lola T70 showed up in Auto Week, or Competition Press, I guess it was. And, it's priced right. So I called the guy, and he told me about the car, and I said, okay. I said, we'll be up for it this weekend. So we loaded the family up and went up to Lime Rock, Connecticut, is where it was. And it was a John Surtees car. Good history on it, and the engine wasn't quite what he said it was, but that's neither here nor there. So we would bring it back, and within a week, the rules came out for the next year's cars.
Always.
And holy mackerel, they had gone from 13-inch wheels to 15-inch wheels. And I made some phone calls right away, and there was no upgrade for it, nor was it possible. And, oh, boy. So, and then I came to grips with how much it cost to race one of those cars. And I'm sorry to say, the car never hit the track with me. And I didn't have the money to do it. I probably never should have bought it. But I had big ideas.
That's funny. It's a small world. That car was chassis number one, which today, if I was going to place a price tag on it, $1 billion. And I owned it a couple of years after you. It was a terrible thing to drive. But when I sold it for $2,000, I think I made money at it. So times have changed.
And who has it now?
Some fellow who's restored it, and it turns up at Monterey every now and then. But the value to it is chassis number one, and Searchies drove it. And it got destroyed at Mossport, and Mecom rebuilt it, and then people like Bob and I bought it. On that note, we should probably wind things up here anyway.
Anybody got something they want to tell us before we sign off?
Chris, it's Chris. Thanks for getting us together. You know, I think we're, from the junior side, we're all so grateful to have kind of grown up in this sport. We're so grateful and thankful to the fathers we have for creating role models and heroes, aspirations to go chase. And what's great about fathers and sons in the sport is that it's a family sport. It's, you know, a ritual that gets passed down through generations. And I think that from my side, and probably for all of us, if we have kids, to be able to pass on the legacies that our dads created and have the enjoyment and the careers we've all had, it's just been an absolute blessing. And thankful to you for getting us on the phone. It's fun to talk with the Taylors, and always great to hear from the Lightsingers too.
Been looking forward to this one. Anybody else? Thank you, Chris. That's beautiful.
Yeah, this is Rob. I raced against both Bob and Wayne, and I was honored to be able to be on this call to be with them, who were great racers and great competitors. And it is interesting that our kids adapted our manner and approach, because we all ran clean, we all ran smart. We brought the cars home, and that's exactly what the kids do. So it's great to see the same theme through three different families.
Yeah, this is Wayne. I would agree with Rob and Bob, and what you guys probably don't know, you, Rob, Chris, Butch, when I came over here, I was extremely envious of you guys, of what you had built, obviously, in your own business, and then was able to run these race teams and have your sons in it. And, you know, I always looked at that thinking, gosh, am I ever going to be able to get to that point? And it was something that I was had to be driven to do. And, you know, you always want to do everything for your kids, like both of you guys have. And when I think about it today, and I had to have my life over, I wouldn't change a thing. And I just feel fortunate that we've been able to do this, and that I've got two sons that have embraced the sport and done as well as they have, and I've driven against Chris and Butch, and of course I think I drove against you guys. No, we drove together, Butch, you're right, at some point. And Chris, I think we've raced against each other.
But
I know you have.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the time, and thank you very much.
Well, Wayne, you did one good season with my boss, and he remembers it well, and he sends his regards from Jim Downey.
Right. Yeah, I won my first championship with Jim Downing.
Yeah, I know it. Good old Mazda. He still runs a number 63.
Yeah, probably the ugliest race car I ever drove in my life. But we won the championship.
Call him sometime.
So it looked better.
He would love to hear from you.
Yeah.
I'll text you his phone number.
All right, thank you, guys.
I just want to say thank you so much for getting us together and great to talk to all of you, and good luck to Chris and Jordan in the races coming up.
That's quite a dynasty they got going there.
You betcha. Congratulations, thanks, everybody. Thanks for being a part of it.
We're still
good.
On.
Thanks for everything, guys.
It's been fun. I really appreciated all of you. I've enjoyed getting to know you. Our next show will be June 15th, a Wednesday night, when we will proudly present the Grand Poobahs of IMSA, John Doonan, Mark Rapoff, and Bo Barfield. I know for a fact that they are witty and wise experts in their field, so we'll be expecting searing comments and absurd stories on the state of racing in IMSA. So, that's our show for tonight. Thank you to our audience for joining us tonight. Thank you for our guests. I can't thank you enough. You're all just wonderful. And thank you, Dave Wallen, for producing. And check it out on racingproject.com or iHeartRadio. Come see us next time.